Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All. Less work, more clean. Terms apply.
I'm Jason Pack.
And I'm Alex Hall Hall. And this is Disorder, the podcast which tries to make sense of our mad world.
It's also the podcast where we share with you our depressing and disordered experiences of trying to buy a car or insure a car in the UK, or deal with a cell phone contract, or wait on hold for like 2 hours and then, you know, have to talk to some automaton. I firmly believe that these crazy interactions with the dysfunctional world of customer service gives us some insights into how things don't work in the world around us. The term is inshittification. Inshittification is a technical term coined by Cory Doctorow in November 2022 to describe a pattern of decreasing quality observed in online services and products such as Amazon, Facebook, Google, Reddit, Uber, and of course, Twitter under Elon Musk. Amazingly, this term was selected by the American Dialect Society as its term of 2023, its word of the year. So what Doctorow means by inshittification is that a platform comes into being, it's good to its users, it's useful, it captures users. Then it abuses their users to make things better for their business customers, to get advertisements, maybe to siphon the data from the users to sell to the advertisers. And then finally, they're bad to their business customers and their users as they claw value back for themselves and become useless. But the barrier to exiting the platform is so high that, you know, you really have difficulty switching from Twitter to Blue Sky or from Amazon to an alternative service. So just, it becomes inshittified. We're gonna talk major inshittification on this podcast.
So, Jason, it's been a while since you and I have chatted together. We've tended to do quite a few individual interviews. I've loved hearing some of your more recent interviews. But this is really nice for us to sit down and catch up on what's been going on in our mad world.
It's really great to be back on the pod with you, Alex. I miss the order of seeing your face, hearing your clipped tones and shortened vowels, and not having to deal with the builders, or my new drama and saga is the Kafkaesque nature of the British insurance system vis-a-vis buying a car.
Oh, tell me more.
Well, as a naive American, I had predicated my move here to the suburbs rather than central London on the idea that I would drive for my errands, but mostly own a car to go to the continent. And I actually purchased a car earlier this week, and it turns out that I'm unable to get insurance for it.
Why not?
Well, in the UK, the car and the driver are insured, and you can't like insure the car and have anyone drive it. And due to anti-Americanism plus Brexit, there is a desire on behalf of the insurers to deny insurance for someone who wants to drive a left-hand drive car, hasn't had a UK license for 3 years, blah, 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 blah. But what's bizarre is I had all of it lined up to go buy this BMW, which was a hybrid, left-hand drive, automatic, environmentally safe, you plug it in, all the things that I wanted. At the car place, even though I had the reservation, he's like, you had the reservation, but we sold that car. I'm like, but I had the reservation. Oh, that's the reservation to test drive the car. It doesn't hold the car, but I have another one exactly like it. So the other one was exactly like it to my specs. I purchased it, but because it's a Toyota, the insurer won't insure a Toyota, even though it's the same thing, a hybrid, automatic, left-hand drive, exactly the same price. I've been on with all the great and the good of the insurance world. they simply won't insure it because the BMW, apparently, even though it's left-hand drive, they can treat it as right-hand drive in a overall German car policy. No such thing exists for Toyotas. They won't insure it. I can't buy the car. I can't even co-buy it with a British woman and share it. Because apparently you can't share a car.
You mean if you had an arranged marriage with a British woman, you still couldn't insure a car?
I was actually planning on buying a car with a British friend because it's not like I'm going to use it frequently, but that's not allowed.
No. You have to be insured individually. The car has to be insured. You have to be insured. But the bit that really intrigues me is why you want to get a left-hand drive car. I mean, you live in the UK now.
It's true. I guess there's the extent to which it's 1 foot in, 1 foot out. Do you know that that's the very nature of my life here? I'm hedging my bets against developments in the States and the global enduring disorder in general. But when I was a graduate student, I rented cars and obviously rented British side drive cars. And I feel that they're unsafe for those of us who grew up driving continental side drive cars. I bumped mirrors. I've had other stuff, all of which has never happened to me. You know, in the States, I've driven for 20 years and like 300,000 miles and never had an accident, really. I also want to drive mostly to the continent. The car will exist for me to go, you know, for my summer holidays and to go to a conference in Brussels. I'm the classical Eurocrat global elite, so I want to have my car mostly to be going to Europe. And it would be insane as an American to be driving a British side drive car in the American side drive situation in Belgium or France.
Okay, I'm waving my hands here and shaking my head because, Jason, you are mad. When you are driving on the left in the UK, you need to have a right-hand drive
car. I don't think
car so. Because that is the safest way to navigate our tiny roads. But by far the biggest reason why you are crazy to premise your purchase of a car on the fact that you're trying to keep 1 foot in the US. I mean, you're not going to drive that car from the UK to the US. And by the way, you can't now because the huge port of Baltimore, where most cars come in, is now jammed up for months and years. So that's a flawed premise. But I think you don't know what is about to hit traffic between the UK and the continent. The Europeans are about to introduce new facial screening technology and new travel and visa requirements, which are going to make it way, way slower for travelers going from the UK into the EU. And where it used to take under a minute to scan each car as they loaded onto a ferry or Eurostar or whatever, it's now some experts are saying it could take up to 5 minutes. And people are predicting the most unholy, god-awful, almighty traffic jams. And Kent, the Garden of England, which is already being covered with parking lots to manage all the cargo trucks and delays as a result of Brexit, it's going to be even worse. You should not try to drive from the UK to Europe. You should fly and rent a car there.
I think that you're living in the real and I'm living in the how things should be. It shouldn't be that you can insure a BMW left-hand drive automatic, but not a Toyota, or that a Japanese car is going to cost £6,000 more to insure than a German car. But I think there's a larger principle here. A lot of this, you know, silly banter about, I want to insure my car, showcases the way in which things really don't work. They don't deliver for the consumer slash citizen the services and products and goods that are needed to have a functioning and productive society. Maybe that's quite a big indictment of how there's really been a fire sale since Thatcher, gradually culminating in the last 13 years of Tory rule. And this connects the NHS to the cell phone services to trying to insure your car. It's all been inshittified, and it really worries me.
So, Jason, did you see the Conservative Party political ad that they put out portraying London as a kind of Islamist hellscape? It's got this is London crime, smog, fear, stalking the streets. I mean, it was the most absurd, overhyped, atrocious, fake party political broadcast I think I have ever seen. It's not the London that most people know and think about.
You feel that you're in the center of the universe here in a way that New York, I think, felt for an earlier generation before it became a shop town for finance and fashion. You know, New York used to have people who did policy and who were intellectuals. That has ceased because they can't afford to live there anymore. And London is an everything town. It's a town where you have every kind of art and policy making, but you also have finance and fashion and culture and charities and every kind of religion and ethnic group. Do you know what I mean? It's a truly an everything town. But going back to the ad, I think that those things are so overplayed that they will hurt the Tories, because obviously they use New York subway footage in that clip. And it's like it's so transparently dumb. The transition from Theresa May to Boris Johnson was from a serious politician trying to implement a flawed policy to just amateur hour. And that people have understood that the Tories now represent foppish amateur hour. And it's not just that they, you know, are Etonians who are making policies while they're at their clubs. It's that they can't even hire people who are really professional, so that the attack ad is done by like a person who doesn't know how to edit video properly.
It was probably the godson or goddaughter of some Etonian politician who was serving an internship at Conservative Party headquarters. It has sort of amateur written all over it. And maybe this bright young intern had spent a semester at a college in the US and had sort of picked up these radical, new, and exciting political ideas.
I think you're onto something, which is the cross-pollination here. Boris Johnson also, to my mind, represented a culmination of a many decade-long process where British politics have become Americanized. Lack of consensus between the parties, ideological attacks, I guess what you would call culture wars, and now, you know, the war on woke, which Sunak has really embraced. But it doesn't work in the UK because it's like just taken from an American playbook and he thinks it will get him elected. I also think all this shit is going to backlash and that UK politics is going to get more normal when Starmer comes in and the culture wars are out and, you know, things are just getting more normal. But we have established before that I am delusional in my belief that things essentially have to work out when all evidence shows to the contrary.
Yeah, like your episode with Brian about we try to find patterns and meaning in some quite random and chaotic events. And sometimes when you think things can't get any worse, they actually do. It's been described as the Bannonization of British politics. So for me, sitting here in the US, I mean, to watch Liz Truss at the absolutely ghastly CPAC event that took place at the harbor just north of Washington, D.C., just across the line in the state of Maryland, and her playing to the audience and her cycling out of all the tropes about the deep state and people trying to thwart her. And she even put the FT and The Economist in the deep state. I wrote an article for Byline Times where I compared her to a sort of marionette sitting on the lap of Steve Bannon, and he was sort of acting like a puppeteer, and she was sort of obediently parroting all these sort of ridiculous lines. Now, I understand, because I think she's got a complete bird brain and absolutely no principles. I don't understand someone like Rishi Sunak, who I keep sort of waiting for this sort of more sober, sensible individual to emerge, but he's going more and more down the rabbit hole, like you said, of sort of embracing these anti-woke cultural wars. But I don't believe he believes in it. That's not who he was.
I don't know if there is a dark heart of Rishi Sunak or if there's any actual consistency at all. You would think that he would be more like a David Cameron or a Jeremy Hunt in traditional conservative one nation Tory kind of values and policy. But my view about the man is that he just will do anything to stay in power. And if it was appointing Braverman to demonize the migrants, he'll do that. And if it's his advisors are whispering in his ear, you know, say that London is run by Islamist terrorists and it's unsafe, he'll do that.
But finding the metaphor for the Conservative Party is pretty difficult. I have a good joke about Donald Trump and the Ten Commandments.
No, but no,
I
want to hear it.
Rishi Sunak. No, but I'm going to finish on okay. Rishi Sunak first, which is, I think it is his head boy nerd persona. I don't believe he has any principles. I have found him grotesquely disappointing as prime minister. And I think what motivates him is he's sort of trying to be the popular kid. He's trying to be in with the in crowd. And he's like the head boy, and he's trying to sort of appeal to the sort of who he thinks are the popular kids. And so he's coming out with ever more stupid stuff, and it's inauthentic. I don't think he really believes in it. He's just sort of chasing after it. But my Donald Trump Ten Commandments joke is that Donald Trump has just started promoting the selling of the Donald Trump Bible for $60 a pop. You can get a Bible endorsed by the Messiah himself, Donald Trump. My joke about that is that he has probably amended the Ten Commandments in the Bible so that the commandments referring to adultery, false witness, stealing, covetousness have all been removed. And the only commandment that exists is the very first one, which is, thou shalt not believe in any God but me.
I love it.
After the break, we're going to continue this theme. Which country is more crazy these days, the UK or the US? All right, Jason. So who's made the more fucked up decision? You to move to London or me to move to Washington?
Oh, God. It depends on what day you ask me. I really love London and I have so many interesting friends. I meet interesting people. Everything having to do with the builders and overpaying and the inability to buy the car. And I get rained on all the time when I'm on my cycle. I'm willing to put up with it for the kind of intellectual and cultural life that I can have here. But I need to have a bloody car because otherwise I set out and it looks sunny or I check my weather app and I'm like, great, I can go about my day. And then I'm on my bike. I don't have on my rainproof Gore-Tex like ski pant things that I cycle in if I know it's going to rain. And then I get drenched and I appear for dinner with friends and like my jeans are just soaked through. It's embarrassing, Alex.
There's no such thing as bad weather. There's just the wrong clothes. So you always have to be prepared in the UK. Well, I think your decision does make sense. I think London and the UK is such a rich cultural, intellectual space. And despite the politics and the dire economic situation for many, many people, especially outside the Southeast, when I read some of the statistics, I'm actually rather frightened. There was a wonderful video made by Annette Dittert, an excellent German journalist based in London, exposing some of the hardships outside London. But yes, if you are fortunate enough to have enough income, I think the UK is a fabulous place to live. And actually, for me, America makes sense. For my children, I can get dentist's appointments for my kids at very short notice. I have had some of the best medical treatment of my life here. I had cancer. It was diagnosed early and it was treated within weeks. And I was very lucky. The schools here, at least where I live, the schools are great and they teach such great stuff. So in addition to all the classical history, math, English, a language, my son has had driver's ed classes taught in school. He's had sex ed, which I appreciate. And he is going to take a mandatory course in how to manage personal finances. I think those are all pretty good.
I never had that. I'm really impressed, Alex. But for the listeners, I want to point out that where you live in Northern Virginia is not only a very global place, but I would say it has the best of America, like baseball and lawns and the ability to go into the countryside, but you also have the proximity to DC and people who come from other cultures and stuff. And that's a nice mix that if, you know, you were in Ohio or even potentially, you know, further south in Virginia, you wouldn't have all those, you know, nice advantages.
Absolutely. And in fact, the teachers at my son's school told me that because I was complimenting them on what they were doing to help my son. And they said, it's not like this in every school system.
There are advantages and disadvantages to the US and the UK. I think that I'm not unique in the observation I'm going to articulate now, but I've kind of honed it to a comedy routine, which is that life in the US is convenient and life in Britain might be uplifting or inspiring, but the convenience of suburban American life with your car and the amazing supermarket and all that stuff, of course I'd miss that. Here in Britain, life is not easy. And you say if you have enough money, things are good. I would argue that a lot of the things that you would want as a non-Brit in Britain cannot be purchased. For example, the thing that with the insurance that I was describing to you, it's not a question of my needing to pay more. They simply won't insure me in the car because I don't have a British driver's license for 3 years and because I want to drive a left-hand drive car. So I can't buy my way out of it. I just can't achieve it. And the thing with my builders, I've paid a ton, but like the underfloor heating doesn't work. I can't pay more. It just simply has been screwed up. So the convenience factor in the UK, I think that if you're an oligarch, yes, you pay like a property management person who manages the builders and you pay someone to manage the insurers. But if you're a regular middle-class person, it's not even just a question of throwing money at it, which is to me very interesting. That convenience is not something that can be solved with money. It just simply doesn't exist.
So the British Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, was recently quoted as having, I think he said it in a tweet, that he had run into a constituency member who was expressing how difficult it was, even on a salary of £100,000 a year, to make ends meet. And he was expressing empathy because the cost of housing in the Southeast is so high. And it led to a tsunami of criticism on Twitter. Because £100,000 is like the top, I don't know, 5%,
you know,
2%.
I actually did some research here on this because I saw the same interview you did, or I think it must have been the same one. I was shocked to learn that only 3% of British earners make more than £100,000 a year, whereas a whopping 27% of Americans make more than $100,000 a year. Of course, $100,000 is only £80,000. So if we stick with that figure, 5 or 6% of Brits make above it, but 27% of Americans do. And this really explains, if you're middle class in America as opposed to in England, you have so much more money and the amount of convenience that you can buy with your degree. And anecdotally, if you're a British trained lawyer who does both American and British law, so you've passed the US bar in, say, New York or Washington, and you're also a British trained, say, an Oxford educated lawyer, so that you can deal with a multinational, say, that works in the cosmetic or pharmaceutical industry where they have British and American operations and you need to know the law in both. The same job in the same position, the London salary is frequently only 60% of the Manhattan salary for the same job. If you move to the Manhattan office, your salary instantly jumps even though you haven't gotten a promotion. That really explains to me kind of how things work differently.
So the thesis behind my question when I said, who was more crazy, you moving to London or me moving to America? As you said, America is a very convenient place to live. And when you have a young family like I do, this is a good time to be here. But the underlying premise was really about whose politics are more messed up. And you are setting out the prospect that the UK might be, hopefully, about to put itself back on a slightly more sensible course. And I think there will be the fringe conservatives who will be tempted to move to the Reform Party. The Conservative Party may go into the wilderness, it may split, it may embrace more extreme ideas before it gets its act together. But yes, the UK does have the chance to put itself back on a slightly more sensible track. Here, we are on the brink of some unprecedented election, and that still sends chills down my spine for reasons I don't need to spell out to our listeners, because you and I have talked about it. The question I have is, if, God forbid, Trump won in November, how bad is that going to be for people living in America? Or is the real impact for everybody else around the rest of the world, especially, you know, security in Europe? I mean, that's the question that I ask myself. I know that Trump is going to go after what he sees as the deep state. I know he's going to mess with America's democratic institutions, its court system, the FBI, the Department of Justice are all in his sights. And there may be serious economic consequences as well as political consequences. But is America itself, you know, going to go into a complete tailspin? Or is the unpredictable nature of Trump, his affinity for dictators like Putin and populists like Orban or Bolsonaro and the others we've talked about, is that going to have more serious, grave consequences for the rest of the world? What do you think? And it's an open question because I fight it in my mind. Are we more screwed up or is the rest of the world more screwed up?
These are unknown unknowns, Alex. I would say that the only guesstimates that we can take are looking at places like Orban's Hungary, Netanyahu's Israel, and Modi's India, because those are consolidated neo-populist systems, to my mind, right? And none of this is provable. If, you know, God forbid, Trump gets in and the Republicans, you know, retake the Senate, which those two things are likely to happen together. It's unclear if he'll govern like he did in the first term, whereby a lot of establishment Republicans in, for example, the orbit of people like Milley's and McMaster's of the world are going to still have a role in foreign policy. That wouldn't be so horrible. That to me seems unlikely. I mean, we don't really know, but what other pundits who study this much closer than I do have put forward is when Trump took the reins of power in 2017, he inherited a Republican Party with a lot of very competent and sane and accomplished people. And he succeeded in purging them over the last 8 years. And therefore, if he comes in, he's really going to be untethered and that he's going to be surrounded by his disciples. There is another school of thought, which is that all he wants to do is to get into power and he doesn't actually care how he governs. And therefore, the statements like, ha, 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 any NATO member who doesn't pay its 2%, like, I'll turn you over to Putin, that he's just saying that because I don't think that the man has like some anti-Estonian views. He has no views. He has no views on Estonia. Do you know what I mean? And it's not like he's ready to toss those Slovenians overboard. He doesn't have any views on this. So, you know, it might be similar to the first term. I am pessimistic because I think the only thing that we have to go on is looking at Orban, Netanyahu, and Modi. They have consolidated their neo-populism over time. What has happened in all three of those places, a purge of the judiciary or an attempted purge of the judiciary, the turning of privately owned media into quasi-state media. In other words, Orban has either bought or had his oligarchic friends buy opposition media and consolidate a narrative. In India, part of the reason why we've discussed that there is no longer a Congress party worth speaking about is that the media has been cowed by the BJP and opposition politicians are either imprisoned or they can't get airtime or they're in fear for their lives. And that's a situation which we don't know if that's going to happen. You know, that will Fox News essentially make it impossible for people to say opposition viewpoints? And will the courts be going after people like me for my views? I mean, I don't want to get to DEFCON 5 on this because I feel like it is difficult in as robust and complex a society as America to, you know, to consolidate that kind of neo-populism. So I'm worried, but not terrified.
So I'm a little bit more optimistic about America's ability to survive, not least because of the existence of state governments. So there is a natural balancing there. So even if things are going crazy at the federal level, that's not going to stop individual states governing themselves and managing their situation and acting as some sort of a balance. I am more worried about the international repercussions, not because I think Trump has a coherent worldview and, you know, has a systematic plan to forge alliances with authoritarian leaders, but more that things can happen by accident, because I do think there's been a grain of thought that's been consistent running through Trump's head. Why do we spend all this money protecting all these countries far off? He doesn't understand that European security is part of American security. If you were Putin, this is your moment to try and grab back Estonia. And I don't think Trump would send troops to protect Estonia. I just don't think he would. And so there's that gamble.
Again, I want to push back here, Alex. He correctly grasps that large swaths of the American electorate don't understand the connections between Eastern European security and American security. And therefore, electorally, it makes sense for him to say that. But the deep state, to use his term, will still be in charge of our security policy. And I think it would be very, very difficult, you know, if a NATO member was attacked, to not invoke Article 5. Yes, that you could imagine some kind of apocalyptic scenario where he either withdraws from NATO or he so undermines things, but we just really don't know there.
There is a counter, which I often hear people put forward, though I don't particularly find it persuasive or reassuring, which is that all the conflicts we're seeing bubbling up in the world now happened on Biden's watch. And they didn't happen on Trump's watch because he was so unpredictable that that in itself scares President Xi and President Putin, that, you know, he could be the wacky, such a stupid guy. He really would use nuclear weapons, whereas nobody really thinks Joe Biden would. So there is that, but I don't find that a very reassuring idea.
I find that absolutely absurd. The reason that Putin would have invaded Ukraine during Trump is because Trump would just have given Putin the things that he wanted in Eastern Europe anyway. The idea that somehow Trump's random megalomania that he might pull the nuclear trigger leads to a coherent and systematic deterrence, I find that absolutely absurd. But Alex, always great to chat through the disorder with you. This has been a very disorderly treatment of our disordered universe.
We've not been together for a little while, so it was just fun doing this.
If you'd like hearing about the mundane travails of getting insurance and of shopping, you can follow this show so you never miss an episode.
We're also on social media. Just search Disorder Show.
If you want more backgrounds on our humdrum lives and my take on things, please subscribe to the Substack by following the link in the show notes.
All that remains is for me to thank our producer, George McDonough, and our executive producer, Neil Fern.
We hope you have an orderly and thoroughly uninsurified week. Hello, we have a post-episode update. Amazing, amazing, amazing. I have actually got my insurance from none other than Tesco Bank. Who knew that Tesco Bank offered insurance? Well, they don't. Tesco Bank is a broker for insurance that I was able to reach through magicmoney.co.uk, who offered lots of different insurance options for me. And I could buy them from real insurers like Aviva or from Tesco Bank, which is itself acting as a middleman between the real insurers. And I think due to my good driving record in the US or my postcode or whatever, they were able to offer me the insurance. So I couldn't achieve it with a human and spent no fewer than 10 hours on hold over the course of 2 weeks. But it was solved within a half an hour online. by purchasing a policy through a middleman, which uses a middleman, which then slices and dices some policies from a real insurer, and no one has actually probably ever greenlit my policy. Amazing.